Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're exploring a truly exciting frontier, human health and performance. It really feels like we're on the cusp of, well, a profound renaissance, you know, where breakthroughs are making it possible to address almost any biological challenge. I'm genuinely eager to uncover just how interconnected everything is, from our diet to our environment, and bring you the most potent knowledge from this space.
It's an exhilarating time, absolutely. My recent presentation, Biohacking the Future, was built on this very premise. The idea that the tools to fix almost anything are, well, they're within our grasp now.
Absolutely. And this deep dive, it's all about that cutting-edge biohacking, the optimization of our bodies, our minds, and just how surprisingly interconnected everything really is. You know, supplements, sunlight, the whole picture. We've sifted through expert insights, real-world applications, all to bring you the most potent knowledge.
Yeah, filtering the signal from the noise.
Exactly. Our mission today is to equip you, our listener, with a holistic understanding of performance, of wellness, revealing what truly drives change, and maybe what's holding you back. This deep dive is brought to you by InfinityPeptide.com. And we're unpacking insights from an incredible individual today, a master of applied biology, really. Someone with, what, a staggering 15,000 plus case studies. He's worked with everyone, from elite athletes aiming for Olympic gold to individuals facing chronic illness. And he operates from this profound belief that there's almost no biological problem that can't be fixed.
That's a powerful starting point.
So what's at the heart of this entire approach? It's this philosophy he calls earning your optimization, this powerful idea that, you know, cutting-edge compounds aren't magic shortcuts. They're complements to a solid foundation.
That's precisely it. The profound insight here is that these advanced compounds, peptides, hormones, whatever they are, they act as amplifiers. If your foundational health is weak, you're essentially just, well, amplifying a poor signal. It doesn't get you very far.
Right, makes sense.
But by mastering the basics first, and we'll get into what those are, you unlock this synergy. It transforms these marginal gains you might get from advanced stuff into truly monumental shifts. That's what elevates you to a super physiological level.
That foundational approach, it just makes intuitive sense. But in your vast experience, what's the biggest mistake people make when they think they've nailed the basics, but then they jump to these advanced compounds too soon? What are those subtle signs that someone isn't really ready, that they haven't quite earned their optimization yet?
Yeah, that's a great question. The most common pitfall, honestly, underestimating the impact of chronic low-grade stress and inadequate sleep. It's huge. People might be eating clean, hitting the gym, but if they're constantly running on fumes or battling that internal stress, their body's basically in a state of defense. It's surviving, not thriving.
So the system's already overloaded.
Exactly. Then you add these advanced compounds, these powerful signals, onto an already overwhelmed system. And you often get burnout, not optimization. The signs are often subtle, like persistent fatigue that doesn't make sense, irritability, energy levels all over the place, or just not seeing the kind of results you'd expect from these potent interventions. It feels flat.
Okay, so what are these essential basics then? The things we absolutely need to master first to avoid that kind of burnout and really set the stage.
Okay, fundamentals. It starts with consistent high-quality sleep, non-negotiable, and effective stress management techniques. Then balanced high-quality nutrition. Think whole, real foods, minimizing processed stuff, coupled with a clean, adequate water supply often overlooked.
And exercise.
Crucially, effective exercise programming. And that means a mix. You need some prophylactic cardio for heart elasticity. You need those parasympathetic walks, just enjoying life, nasal breathing, low heart rate for stress reduction and fat burning. And then you need some high-intensity training, HIT, to really improve your body's oxygen handling capacity.
That's a comprehensive view of exercise.
It is. And beyond that, getting the right light exposure will definitely impact that later. And critically, the softer stuff. A good life, good family, a strong sense of purpose. All the longevity research, the blue zone stuff, it consistently shows connection and purpose are vital for people living over 100. You absolutely need those basics lowered down before you even think about the advanced stuff.
It really is about setting that stage for success. Once those fundamental building blocks are solid, robust, that's when you can truly leverage things like supplements, peptides, hormones to push into that super physiological territory.
100%. They work exponentially better when the body's baseline is already optimized. It's night and day.
Okay, let's talk about one compound that's been, well, it feels like it's everywhere lately. Going viral, methylene blue. I mean, there's even that widely shared video of Robert Kennedy taking it. What exactly is this stuff and why is everyone suddenly so fascinated?
Methylene blue, yeah. It's fascinating. The real question with methylene blue isn't what does it do? It's more like what doesn't it do?
Hmm.
But the truly astonishing insight isn't just the long list of benefits. It's how it works. It's a fundamental energy booster at the cellular level.
Okay.
By upgrading the engine of your entire cellular system, your mitochondria, it unlocks this whole cascade of improvements.
Hmm.
It's optimizing your body's most basic power source. So as a nootropic aid, it significantly enhances cellular metabolic activity in the brain. We call it driving up CM ball, basically boosting energy production, overall brain function. It powerfully modulates the electron transport chain, making it a potent energetic aid that improves ATP creation. That's your cellular energy currency. It can also drive direct fat loss and even indirect anabolism, helping build muscle. And there's even potential for targeted drug delivery into tumors.
How does that work?
It can hyperoxygenate them. And with light activation, it can help push drugs directly into cancer cells. So yeah, it's truly multifaceted.
And its origin story is pretty surprising too, isn't it? Not exactly high-tech lab stuff initially.
Not at all. It actually started as a simple blue dye used for fabrics and even food coloring way back.
Mm-hmm.
Been around for centuries. Researchers initially just observed its interactions with the electron transport chain, and then boom. The research exploded as its broad benefits became clear.
You mentioned the electron transport chain. For those of us whose biology classes are a distant memory, can you quickly clarify how methylene blue helps create ATP, that primary energy source?
Yeah, sure. Think of your cells having these tiny power plants, right, called mitochondria. Inside them, there's an assembly line that's the electron transport chain that creates energy. Methylene blue basically helps this assembly line run super, super efficiently. It helps electrons move along smoothly, so you crank out more ATP, more energy for everything your body does. It optimizes that whole upstream process.
Got it. So it's boosting the efficiency of the power plants. But it's not just about physical energy. It has profound effects on the brain and mood too, right?
Absolutely. It acts as an MAOI inhibitor. What that means is it helps prevent the breakdown of key brain chemicals like dopamine and serotonin. Those are your feel-good and focus neurotransmitters. So methylene blue helps keep them around longer in the brain.
Which makes you feel?
More alert, more focused, generally more positive for most people. And what's really compelling is its potential to reverse neuroinflammation. It's being seriously looked at for TBI, traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's, dementia, Alzheimer's, especially when it's paired with creatine.
Interesting combination.
Yeah. And even if you're just sleep deprived, it can give your brain a bit of leeway for cleaning itself out because that brain cleaning system, the glymphatic system, is most active during deep sleep.
That is an incredibly diverse list of benefits. Almost sounds too good to be true for just one compound. So given all that, what's the most common misconception you see when people start trying it? And are there any specific red flags, maybe beyond just feeling hyperstimulated, that listeners should really be aware of?
Okay, biggest misconception. More is always better. It's just not true with methylene blue. People jump to these high doses. They feel way too wired, hyperstimulated, anxious even. And then they just dismiss the compound entirely.
So if that happens?
It's almost always a sign your dosage is too high. Just pull it way down. Start low, like really low, maybe 1 to 5 milligrams, and slowly increase. From a negative side effect standpoint, look, there's an incredibly rare potential for renal failure effects.
Uh-huh.
Talking like 0.00000001% of people due to a specific genetic mutation. And it's reversible if you start taking it.
Okay, extremely rare.
Extremely. And it's not directly addictive like, say, cocaine. It doesn't regulate dopamine receptors in the same way. But people can certainly get attached to feeling that good, that focused. But here's the crucial warning. Because it's an MAOI inhibitor and it affects brain chemistry, you must be extremely careful about cross-indications, other brain-affecting compounds, certain HRT protocols, traditional peptides. Big no-no without careful consideration.
So caution is key.
Absolutely. Always start incredibly low. Layer compounds in slowly one at a time. See how you react. Don't just throw everything at the wall.
Very wise advice. Moving from those broad benefits to something deeply personal for you, our expert, let's dive into the fascinating world of cognition and brain repair. I know this area is particularly close to your heart because of your own profound experiences.
It is, yeah, very much so. In high school, I suffered a traumatic brain injury, a TBI. It was severe,
mm-hmm.
left me unable to walk, talk, or even eat for 6 months. I essentially lost 6 months of my life. It took me years, literally years, to recall those memories. It was a black hole.
Wow.
And that experience, it fundamentally drove my personal quest for cognitive repair, especially because, honestly, I considered myself naturally unintelligent beforehand. I had poor memory, struggled academically. That struggle, that injury, it put me squarely on the exact path of discovery I'm on today, constantly seeking ways to fix, to optimize, to repair.
Your incredible personal journey from that debilitating TBI to, well, we'll get to your astonishing quad recovery later. It truly embodies this earning your optimization idea, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Can you share how that initial struggle, that TBI, specifically shaped your entire approach to understanding the body's just profound capacity for repair?
That TBI, it was the crucible, really. Before that, like most people, I probably assumed there were hard limits to the brain to recovery. Mm-hmm. But when I went through that and saw what my body could do, given the right inputs, the right environment, and just relentless effort, it shattered those assumptions. It showed me firsthand that the brain is not static. It's profoundly plastic. It can recover. It can adapt. It can even grow stronger, more capable than before. That experience became the bedrock, the absolute foundation for understanding that if you support the core biological mechanisms, the body's capacity for healing is truly extraordinary, far beyond what most people think.
That's powerful. So with that firsthand, hard-won understanding, what's in the arsenal? What are the key tools for truly boosting and repairing the brain?
Okay, so beyond methylene blue, and low-dose nicotine, which we can touch on, for neural repair. Cerebellicin is a key player. It's derived from pig's brain. Sounds a bit weird. But it contains this comprehensive array of neurotrophic factors. Essentially, every neurotropic counterpart you could want, driving neural healing from multiple angles.
It's used clinically.
Oh, yeah. It's gained significant recognition of the Alzheimer's and dementia communities for its regenerative properties. But it's not just for disease states. For high-performing individuals, you know, entrepreneurs, executives, people constantly crushing their brains with intense mental work. A low dose, maybe 1 to 5 milliliters intramuscularly on Saturday and Sunday, can literally drive the repair process from that week's cognitive load.
Weekend brain repair.
Exactly. You know, they used to think after 40, your brain just stopped growing, started declining. That's simply not true. We now know the brain is always plastic. You literally hypertrophy it like a muscle, make it function better, recall more memories, improve speech, overall processing speed. It's trainable.
And what about countering some of the modern assault on the brain? Things we're all exposed to, like microplastics or those amyloid plaques associated with Alzheimer's.
Right, the modern environment.
Yeah.
For microplastics, compounds like carbon-60, C60, also known as fullerenes, are incredibly interesting. Think of them like tiny cellular sponges. They can get deep into your cells, even into the mitochondria, and basically pull out harmful free radicals and cellular junk, what we call the oxidative load that causes damage. Things like NMN and PQQ also help with clearing that cellular debris and driving the lymphatic system.
Which cleans the brain during sleep, right?
Exactly. That glymphatic system, it's crucial. Now, regarding amyloid plaques, the current thinking is shifting. They seem to be more of a side effect than a cause. They're likely sequestering toxins, walling them off to prevent them from causing wider problems. So the plaques themselves might not be the primary villain. It's the toxins they're holding.
So the focus shouldn't be just attacking the plaques.
Probably not solely. The focus should be on hyperdriving that lymphatic system, bathing the brain in blood and cerebrospinal fluid during sleep to clear out the underlying toxins before they get sequestered. Carbon-60, PQQ, good sleep hygiene. These are excellent for supporting that process.
And exogenous ketones, where do they fit into brain health?
Ah, ketones. They act as powerful cellular signals, not just fuel. They can actually help reactivate the thymus gland, which often calcifies and shrinks after age 30, helping it pump out the body's own endogenous peptides again. They also act as an intracellular aid for producing these peptides. And what's really compelling is you don't have to be in deep ketosis to benefit.
You can use them even if you eat carbs.
Yes. They can be used simultaneously with glucose. The brain loves having that dual fuel option. I personally use them quite often, especially if I'm sleep deprived, just to ensure my brain has optimal fuel and functions at its best.
Fascinating. Okay, let's switch gears slightly and talk about nicotine. Now, many people hear nicotine and immediately think cigarettes, addiction, all the negatives. But the data, especially from recent years, tells a surprisingly nuanced story, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. A really significant insight emerged during the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. Data showed that low-dose nicotine, we're talking maybe 0.5 to 1 milligram, was actually protective against long COVID.
Oh.
It seems to work by occupying nicotinic receptors in neural tissue. By sitting in those receptors, it basically prevented the virus from binding there and causing neurological issues. Now, this is vastly different from the high doses, the tar, the carcinogens, the thousands of other harmful compounds you get from smoking cigarettes.
Yeah.
Worlds apart.
And administration is key here, obviously. We're absolutely not talking about smoking.
Exactly. Zero smoking. We're talking about non-smoking delivery methods. Things like lozenges, gums, maybe patches like Zen P. These deliver the nicotine without the lung damage and all the other toxins.
Got it. So beyond that protective role against certain viruses, what are the nootropic benefits, the brain-boosting effects of nicotine when used appropriately like this?
Yeah, as a nootropic, it's quite potent. It acts as a high-tier nootropic by hyperdriving neural action. It significantly enhances focus, alertness, reaction time for many people. It's also shown some antiviral properties against the common flu virus, interestingly.
But there's a cost to that stimulation.
There can be. This kind of hyperstimulation can burn through your brain's fuel reserves faster, things like acetylcholine, ketones, neuroglucose. So ensuring you're properly fueled is essential if you're using it. Your brain actually produces its own insulin, and nicotine can hyperdrive that process too.
Okay, but the big question remains, addiction. It's often classified as highly addictive. How do you square that with using it for optimization? How do you nuance use versus abuse?
Right. Addiction, at its core, really boils down to dosage, duration, and frequency. It's context dependent. If you take nicotine every single day, especially at higher doses, yeah, your body will likely normalize to it. Your baseline shifts. And stopping will probably lead to withdrawal symptoms. That's dependency.
But infrequent use is different.
Completely different. If you use it infrequently, say, once or twice a week, at a low dose, you're providing a temporary boost. You're elevating your baseline transiently without causing that physiological dependency. The goal isn't to create reliance. It's about strategically stimulating and elevating your body's natural systems, allowing them to operate at a higher frequency temporarily without needing constant external input. It's a nudge, not a crutch.
That distinction makes perfect sense. It's about working with your body's systems, not just overriding or replacing their function. Okay, let's see how these insights come together. Let's talk tailored stacks for peak performance. First up, the entrepreneur's edge, someone looking for that high cognitive function, sustained performance, maybe dealing with high stress.
Okay, yeah, the entrepreneur, usually crushing it Monday through Friday, often into the weekend too. So daily use of everything isn't ideal. It's too much. We need to be strategic, differentiate the days. For their biggest work days, the really demanding ones, typically Monday, Wednesday, Friday, for many, we might use something like Mafil or Methaflu.
What does that do?
It stimulates histamine and orexin meropeptides, primarily from the lateral hypothalamus. This dramatically changes brain firing patterns, boosting memory, recall, even speech fluidity. It's quite potent. You typically start low, maybe 25 or 50 milligrams, and then linearly escalate. Add another 25 or 50 each week until you hit your optimal dose, maybe around 150, 200 milligrams or some. Once you find that sweet spot, you don't just stay there. You can then reverse pyramid down slightly to maintain that elevated baseline long term rather than just sustaining the peak dose.
Interesting approach, the reverse pyramid. And what about the other days? Tuesday, Thursday? Still need support,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
For Tuesday and Thursday, methylene blue often comes in, usually around 20 to 40 milligrams. This helps support the electron transport chain health, keeps the energy flowing, and actively clears neural inflammation that might build up from the intense days. Even when you're pushing hard, you still want to drive both performance and recovery simultaneously. It's a balance.
And the weekend. Time for repair.
Exactly. Weekend is repair and recharge time. Specifically Saturday and Sunday, we might start with, say, 1 to 5 milliliters of cerebrolysin intramuscularly, and often pair that with something like urolithin A, which is fantastic for helping recycle the damaged mitochondria from the intense weekday cognitive work, cleaning up the cellular engines.
You also mentioned some other mitochondrial support compounds that could complement this stack.
Yes, definitely. For overall mitochondrial health and recovery, there are peptides like MOSI, that stands for mitochondrial open reading frame. It works more from an inner mitochondrial aspect. Then there's SS31. It's chemically very robust, often used clinically for serious organ healing, like reversing kidney or liver failure. It's quite potent, but can be expensive, typically used at 50 to 100 milligrams.
But there's a caution with these.
Yes, a crucial caution. What we sometimes call overspinning the mitochondria. If you take too many of these mitochondrial boosting peptides like SS31, MOSI, another one called SLU, all at once or in high doses, you can actually overstimulate your mitochondrial ATPase, the enzyme that makes ATP. This can lead to excess reactive oxygen species, cellular stress.
And how did that feel?
It feels like being overstimulated or weirdly lethargic, almost like you've had way too much coffee, jittery but tired. If you experience that, it often tells you one of two things. Either your mitochondria are already functioning pretty optimally and don't need that much of a push, or you're simply overdoing the dose. Paradoxically, if you find you need a lot of these mitochondrial supports just to feel normal, that might be a deeper sign that your mitochondria genuinely need significant help and foundational work.
That's a really fascinating nuance. Feeling sluggish after taking them might actually mean your mitochondria are doing okay, or you're just pushing too hard. Yeah. Okay, let's shift gears. The bodybuilder. Someone focused primarily on building an incredibly aesthetic physique, muscle growth, that kind of thing.
Right, the physique competitor or serious bodybuilder. In their world, neurological input is absolutely paramount. It's not just about moving weight. It's about maximizing quality reps, feeling the muscle contract. Mind-muscle connection is key. So compounds like alpha-GPC are excellent. Specifically, you want the alpha-glycerol-phosphorylcholine, the L-handed isomer, for full efficacy. It helps donate acetylcholine, firing up those neural tissues more effectively.
More brain chemicals for muscle activation.
Precisely. And then there's injectable L-carnitine. This is another key player. Oral versions often have, well, pretty poor bioavailability and can cause gut issues like TMAO elevation. Injectable avoids all that, goes straight to the muscle tissue. And here's a key insight about L-carnitine. It actually increases androgen receptor density in muscle cells.
What does that mean practically?
It means your existing testosterone, whether it's what your body makes naturally or what you might be supplementing with, becomes more effective. Why? Because there are more docking stations, more receptors available for it to bind to and exert its muscle building effects.
Yeah.
Your body becomes more responsive.
So you're essentially making better use of the hormones you already have or are providing. And what about timing for L-carnitine for a bodybuilder? Pre-workout, post-workout.
Both can work, depending on the goal. Pre-workout, it can significantly drive VO2 max, improve nutrient partitioning, getting fuel into the muscles, and has overall anabolic and anti-catabolic effects. Many people notice they sweat more, feel better muscle contractility, get easier pumps. It's an amino acid, nothing too exotic, but effective.
And post-workout.
Post-workout, especially for strength athletes, maybe. Taking L-carnitine can help clear out acetyl groups. These build up during intense training and can hinder recovery. So taking it after can potentially speed up recuperation.
What else is in this aesthetic and anabolic blueprint?
NUPEPT, that's N-phenylacetyl, L-prolylglycine ethyl ester. This compound profoundly affects motor cortex function. It dramatically enhances rep efficiency. That crucial mind-muscle connection we talked about is considered hundreds of times more powerful than pyrimidine, an older nootropic.
Yeah.
And it also helps ameliorate glutamate toxicity, which you can get from stress or even excessive caffeine.
How would a bodybuilder use it?
I'd recommend using it pre-workout, especially when training lagging body parts, to really improve that neural drive and focus on the muscle. Some even use it intranasally for intense focus. And here's a neat trick. Pair taking NUPEPT with an action that drives neuroplasticity, like trying to write cursive with your non-dominant hand. It sounds weird, but it can help strengthen those brain connections.
Really driving that neural input to improve the physical output. What about things like insulin? That's huge in bodybuilding.
Absolutely. Insulin is highly anabolic. A large carbohydrate meal strategically timed can significantly drive insulin release, creating this incredibly anabolic intra-workout environment, especially when combined with amino acids. Even non-hormonal compounds, like the herb Gymnema sylvester, can help stimulate insulin release from the pancreas, enhancing nutrient uptake.
And then there's the growth hormone, or GH side of things, peptides.
Right. So naturally, GH is released in a cascade, starting from the brain. You can use exogenous GH peptides, like tesamorelin or epomorelin, which signal the pituitary to release more GH. But one of my personal favorites in this category, especially for bodybuilders, is MK677, also called ibutamorin.
Why that one specifically?
Because unlike other peptides that just cause a release of GH, MK677 works differently. It primarily drives the enzymatic action of GH reception itself. It makes your body more receptive and sensitive to the growth hormone it's already producing or receiving. The effects: deep REM sleep, significant nitrogen retention, which is key for muscle growth, a feeling of 247 fullness in the muscles, often increased hunger, which helps with bulking, and truly insane pumps during workouts. A dosage around 10 milligrams is usually highly effective.
Wow, that's quite the blueprint for aesthetics and anabolism. Okay, shifting focus again. Healing and recovery, this is critical for athletes, but really for anyone dealing with injury. And you have a particularly compelling, almost unbelievable personal story here, don't you?
I do, yeah. A few years back, I tore my quad muscle badly. almost completely detached from the bone. It was nasty. And I managed to recover, fully functional, in just 4 weeks, using a pretty extreme protocol. But it highlights a key principle. Timeliness is crucial after an injury. The sooner you start appropriate treatment, the faster and better the recovery. As they say in surgery, pre-op dictates post-op recovery. Same idea here.
4 weeks for a near-complete quad tear is frankly astonishing, borderline miraculous. How on earth did you achieve that kind of rapid, profound recovery?
Okay, first, you have to optimize the hormonal environment for healing.
Right.
That means upregulating growth hormone receptors and reception. You need to balance what we call the angiogenic somatotropic and angiogenic axis, basically.
Yeah.
The interplay between growth hormone, insulin, and androgens like testosterone. Get that balance right, and you maximize the body's healing potential. You can support this axis with traditional herbs like tonkata leaf or fenugreek, maybe hormone replacement therapy if appropriate, exogenous GH, or something like MK677 we just discussed.
So setting the hormonal stage, then what?
Once that axis is covered, specific healing peptides can really shine. The big players here are TDBAR500, or thymosin beta-4. Its main role is upregulating neogene expression, essentially helping regress the damaged tissue back towards a pre-damaged, healthier state. Then there's BBC-157. This is fantastic for general tissue recovery. It significantly increases vasculature, new blood vessel growth, improving blood flow and oxygen delivery right to the injured area. Critical for healing. And finally, GHKQ, the blue copper peptide. This one is amazing for driving stem cell migration to the site of injury to an extreme degree. It can even encourage the donation of stem cells from your red bone marrow.
Okay, those are the tools. Can you walk us through your specific accelerated quad recovery protocol? It sounds incredibly intense, but obviously incredibly effective.
It was intense. So that very night of the injury, I immediately administered a bolus, a large dose of growth hormone and growth hormone releasing peptides. We're talking dozens of AUs, arbitrary units. Then I used cupping therapy on the area. This dramatically increases local blood flow, pulls oxygen and nutrients right into the damaged tissue. This was followed by targeted red light and near-infrared light therapy. The goal there is to activate the mitochondria specifically in the injured quad muscle cells, providing the energy needed for the intense repair process.
And you alternated that with something else?
Yes. I would rotate the light therapy off with devices we call test coils or other advanced voltage changers. These apply specific pulsed electromagnetic fields, PEMF, to the area. The idea is that these fields can gently influence cellular healing processes and potentially help guide the damaged muscle tissue back into proper alignment with the bone. I then wrapped the area tightly for about an hour, and I rotated these therapies over those 4 weeks, maybe an hour of infrared, then rotate with the coils to change the voltage and cellular signaling. The result, the muscle grew back perfectly, zero scar tissue. Fully functional.
It's truly incredible what's possible when you combine these cutting-edge tools with an understanding of the body's own healing mechanisms. Okay, let's talk about another huge topic right now, GLP-1s, this new era of metabolic control. Compounds like semaglutide, Ozempic, Wegovy, tirzepatide, Mounjaro, Zepbound, they are genuinely cultural shifting medical interventions for obesity. But are they being used in the bodybuilding world? And if so, how?
Oh, absolutely. They're being used in pretty much every industry now because they are just so powerful. And yes, definitely in bodybuilding, particularly during pre-contest prep when getting extremely lean is the goal. The primary challenge for bodybuilders, though, is that GLP-1s significantly slow down gastric motility, how fast food moves through your stomach. And they also modulate dopamine receptors related to reward, which drastically reduces food desire and appetite.
Which is a problem if you need to eat a lot of calories for muscle growth or maintenance.
Exactly. Mm. It can be really problematic for bodybuilders who often need to consume thousands upon thousands of calories daily, especially in an off-season or growth phase.
Mm.
However, for most people, not just elite bodybuilders, microdosing GLP-1s can be incredibly beneficial. We're talking low doses, maybe 10 to 100 micrograms just a few times per week.
And the benefits at those lower doses?
At those microdoses, you get dramatic improvements in nutrient handling and insulin sensitivity, significant drive in beta oxidation, fat burning, protective effects on organs, and surprisingly, even some positive anabolic interactions. It helps shuttle nutrients more effectively. Then there's retatrutide, which is newer. It's a three-stage agonist, hitting GLP-1, GIP, and glucagon receptors. What's fascinating is that by hyperstimulating the glucagon receptor, it can paradoxically cause hunger in some people.
Hunger. That's the opposite of semaglutide.
Right. It's thought to be due to the drastic anabolism it drives. It makes the body demand fuel. and Retutide appears to directly drive anabolism itself, which is really interesting.
That's a wild effect. So are these compounds typically used constantly, or is there a strategy, like cycling?
Rotation and pulsing are definitely key for long-term use. Constant high-dose exposure can potentially lead to what some call red tri-induced dysfunction. This refers to dysregulation of certain inflammatory pathways, for example, potentially tanking interleukin-6 levels too much, which could then cause downstream issues with immune function, skin health, or lymphatic drainage. So for longevity and sustained benefits, rotation and strategic pulsing are generally preferred over just staying on them continuously at high doses.
What about the fear of muscle loss? That's a common concern people raise with rapid weight loss on these drugs.
Yeah, that's mostly misunderstood. Significant muscle loss seen with GLP-1s is usually due to people drastically cutting calories without simultaneously doing adequate strength training to signal muscle retention. The drug itself isn't inherently catabolic. In fact, GLP-1s are generally considered muscle-sparing, especially when protein intake and resistance training are sufficient. And some, like retatrutide, as we mentioned, might even directly drive anabolism. The context of diet and exercise is crucial.
And the future looks even more advanced.
Definitely. We're already seeing the development of 5-stage agonists in the pipeline. These might modulate things like IGF, insulin-like growth factor, and even androgen receptors, potentially offering even more precise metabolic control and body composition benefits. It's moving fast.
Truly the cutting edge, merging fields that used to feel very separate. Okay, let's transition now to what some listeners might initially perceive as the woo-woo side of biohacking, things that might sound unconventional, but which you've found through experience to be incredibly effective and backed by real-world results. How did you even start exploring these methods?
Honestly, it was born from pure necessity, from hitting walls, trying to solve problems that traditional Western medicine just couldn't fix. Whether it was an elite athlete hitting some inexplicable performance plateau or a patient with persistent, stubborn heart failure despite standard treatments, you start digging deeper. You look at the baseline energetics of the body, the subtle stuff, and you eventually realize there's profound validity, often ancient wisdom, in these concepts that maybe got dismissed along the way.
Like grounding, for instance. For many people, that's just, you know, taking your shoes off and walking on the grass. What's the actual proposed mechanism there?
Grounding, or earthing, is actually elegantly simple at its core. When you make direct contact with the surface of the earth, grass, sand, soil, you're essentially allowing a transfer of free electrons from the earth into your body. At the same time, it's thought to allow built-up static electricity and potentially some toxins to discharge out through the highly porous soles of your feet. Think of eating antioxidant-rich fruit. It donates electrons to neutralize free radicals. Grounding is like doing that on a much broader systemic scale via direct contact. It's a direct energetic exchange with the planet.
Simple yet profound. Mm. Okay, what about structured water? Now, this one definitely might sound like something from a fantasy novel to some. How do you view its impact on health? Is it just H2O?
Yeah, it can sound out there. But consider water in its natural state. Think of a mountain stream flowing over rocks, swirling, energized. It develops a unique, subtle energetic structure or spin. As it moves, it picks up minerals, it creates a subtle electrical charge, it becomes living, dynamic, highly reactive water. This is fundamentally different from the dead tap water many of us drink.
How is tap water dead?
It's typically forced through straight pressurized pipes, often treated with chemicals like chlorine or fluoride. This process tends to strip water of its natural structure and energetic charge. The belief here, which is backed by some fascinating, though still emerging, research from scientists like Gerald Pollack on easy water, is that water isn't just a passive solvent. Its structure matters for how well it hydrates our cells and participates in biological energy transfer. Unstructured water might be a hidden societal problem. Mm. And yes, there are now practical ways people try to restructure their water at home to mimic its natural living state.
You also bring quantum energy and even food frequency into this discussion. Can you unpack that a bit?
Okay, yeah. Stepping into the quantum realm here. The basic concept is that everything in the universe, down to the subatomic level, vibrates or spins at a certain frequency. It has an energetic signature. A truly healthy, whole food, like a sweet potato fresh from the earth, or a piece of pasture-raised chicken, possesses a complex, coherent energetic signature. It spins at a frequency that our biology inherently recognizes, accepts, and resonates with. Compare that to, say, a highly processed artificial Cheeto. Its energetic signature is likely much simpler, less coherent, maybe even chaotic. The idea is our bodies thrive on resonant frequencies. Quantum energy-infused products, like some heal capsules that are available, work on this principle, aiming to introduce beneficial energetic spins or frequencies to influence the body's subtle energy fields.
Very interesting. Let's talk about dry fasting now. This sounds pretty extreme. No food and no water at all.
That's correct. Zero food, zero water. For a defined period, of course. The mechanism is truly fascinating. Your body, under these specific conditions, can actually tap into your fat cells, not just for energy, but for water. Fat cells can dump triglycerides and hydrogen, and through metabolic processes, your body can combine this with oxygen you breathe to create its own endogenous water. Water literally created from within.
Your body makes its own water.
Yes, metabolic water. You can't sustain it indefinitely, obviously, but you can create a sufficient internal water supply to survive for short periods without external intake. We started looking at this extensively in the context of parasites and other pathogens. Many of these unwanted organisms thrive on the glucose and external water you consume, but crucially, most of them cannot make their own endogenous water.
Ah, so dry fasting starves them of water.
That's the theory. By drastically reducing external water and forcing your body to rely on its own internally generated water, you create an environment that's very hostile to these parasites, potentially starving them off. There are Russian studies, some quite old, looking at dry fasting, particularly hard dry fasts, where you avoid all external water exposure, even showering or washing hands for things like potentially reversing cancer and killing off stubborn parasite infections. It's an advanced technique, requires caution, but the biological rationale is compelling.
That truly bridges the gap between, conventional science and some potentially ancient wisdom or extreme biohacks. Okay, let's explore light and environment more. You see these as unseen yet incredibly profound controllers of our health.
Absolutely. Take modern lighting. My view, and it's one shared by a growing number of researchers, is that the pervasive blue light from our devices are LED and fluorescent bulbs. It isn't just about energy saving. There's a real conversation to be had about its profound impact on our biology beyond just sleep disruption. How it affects brain development, cognitive function, potentially influencing neuroatypical behaviors, memory consolidation, maybe even contributing to the decline in skills like cursive writing through its effects on brain coherence. It's about how this very narrow, intense spectrum of light interacts with our biology quite differently than the full spectrum balanced light our ancestors evolved with for millennia.
So contrasting that with older incandescent bulbs.
Exactly. Those old incandescent chicken lights, as some call them, they emit a much fuller spectrum of light, including vital near-infrared frequencies. They provide a more balanced, diverse, energetic input that our bodies, especially our mitochondria, seem to need.
So it's not just about avoiding blue light at night, but the very nature of the light we're bathed in all day.
Precisely. And this ties directly into mitochondrial melatonin and infrared depletion. Most people think melatonin is just made in the pineal gland in the brain for sleep. That's only about 5-10% of it. The vast majority, maybe 90-95%, is actually produced inside our mitochondria throughout the body. And its production is stimulated primarily by exposure to near-infrared light. This mitochondrial melatonin is crucial. It's a master antioxidant, and it's well-established to suppress tumor growth.
And modern life depletes this infrared exposure.
Massively. Modern life spending most of our time indoors, behind glass that blocks infrared, under artificial lights lacking infrared, leads to significant near-infrared light depletion. This directly affects mitochondrial function, energy production, and that vital melatonin production pathway. Getting regular sun exposure, which is rich in infrared, and even doing things like cold therapy are natural ways to stimulate our mitochondria to produce and release the infrared light they actually store and utilize.
Wow. There's an anecdote you mentioned related to extreme light exposure.
Yeah, it relates to some rather grim scenarios involving sensory manipulation, essentially exposing someone to 48 hours of constant, intense, narrow-spectrum blue light, followed by sudden darkness, or perhaps switching to other very specific narrow-spectrum lights. It leads to profound disorientation, cognitive impairment, almost a breakdown of mental function. It powerfully demonstrates how fundamentally our brain function, our sense of reality, is tied to receiving a diverse natural spectrum of light. Take that away, or overload it with artificial spectra, and things go haywire.
That's a really chilling thought, underscoring how fundamental natural light is. So what about sunscreens then? If sunlight contains beneficial infrared, are sunscreens doing more harm than good in some cases by blocking everything?
It's a controversial take, but I believe many common chemical sunscreens can potentially generate more reactive damage on the skin than moderate sun exposure alone. They work by absorbing UV light and converting it into heat right on your skin. This process can generate free radicals and inflammation. So they might essentially blunt the beneficial aspects of sunlight while allowing or even potentiating the negatives. There's research suggesting links between heavy chemical sunscreen use and increased risk of certain skin cancers and systemic ROS overproduction.
So what's the alternative? Just burn?
No, definitely not burn. Mineral-based sunscreens, primarily those using zinc oxide and titanium dioxide, are a far lesser evil, in my opinion. They work by creating a physical barrier that reflects UV rays, rather than absorbing and converting them. But the ideal approach really is to build what's called a solar callus. Treat sun exposure like exercise. Use progressive overload.
How do you do that?
Start with very short durations of unprotected sun exposure during safer times of day, maybe just 10 minutes. Then slowly increase it to 15 minutes, then 20, as your skin adapts and builds its natural melanin protection. Train your skin to handle the sun intelligently. There are also compounds like melanotan-2 or MT2, which stimulate melanin production internally. This can significantly aid in building that solar callus faster and achieving a tan with less sun exposure. But caution is needed. Using MT2 without getting some sun exposure can lead to a rather unnatural, sometimes orange appearance and requires careful dosage.
Building a solar callus, that makes so much sense, applying training principles to sun exposure. Okay, let's look ahead. What does the future of health and optimization look like through your expert eyes?
I genuinely foresee a profound renaissance on the horizon. I think over the next 5, maybe 10 years, we're going to see a really drastic shift. It might create a clearer divide, unfortunately, between the healthy who are truly thriving, living vibrantly into old age, and the sick who are sadly declining and dying prematurely, maybe in their 40s or 50s, from chronic diseases. And part of this, I believe, relates to pathogen evolution. As we humans evolve and strengthen our systems, the bacteria and viruses we coexist with are evolving right alongside us, becoming potentially more challenging for unprepared immune systems.
And you're actively involved in developing some of these future tools, working with Jay Campbell's BioLongevity Lab.
Yes, absolutely. With BioLongevity Lab, we have some truly groundbreaking products in the pipeline, things that we believe could genuinely help reverse obesity at a fundamental level. And then there was a fascinating military-inspired project we explored. Eye drops designed to allow vision in near-total darkness using compounds like chlorine E6 and DMSO. I personally tested them.
You could see in the dark.
For about 4 to 6 hours, yes. It was quite remarkable. However, due to various regulatory hurdles and practical complexities, that specific project won't be commercialized. Just an example of the kind of frontier research happening. We're also developing products aimed at potentiating NAD therapies, not just boosting NAD levels, but modulating other factors that can sometimes fuel cancer or senescent cell growth when NAD is high. The goal is to upregulate the entire NAD system more safely and effectively at a foundational level.
Incredible stuff on the horizon. Before we wrap up this amazing deep dive, I'm really curious to get your perspective on individuals who are pushing the absolute bleeding edge of longevity right now, like Brian Johnson. His highly publicized, data-driven approach is fascinating to many. How does his philosophy align or maybe diverge from your holistic optimization approach?
Yeah, Brian Johnson. He's certainly dedicated, no question. And his commitment to tracking data is admirable in many ways. We need more data. However, I fundamentally disagree with certain core aspects of his approach, particularly his near-complete avoidance of natural sun exposure. From my perspective, that directly down-regulates critical biological pathways.
Like mitochondrial action.
Exactly. Mitochondrial action, neurological development, even prefrontal cortex hypertrophy seem to benefit from the full spectrum of sunlight. Even if he's compensating with, say, extensive red light therapy panels, it's still a very narrow spectrum compared to natural sunlight. Best case scenario, you're trying to artificially simulate some of what would have happened naturally, systemically, if you just went outside and got sensible sun exposure. You're missing the synergistic complexity of the real thing, potentially compromising overall biological resilience and function for the sake of optimizing isolated biomarkers. It feels incomplete from a truly holistic viewpoint.
What an absolutely incredible deep dive today. We have covered such a vast territory, haven't we? From really specific cutting-edge compounds like methylene blue, cerebellin, advanced peptides, all the way to these broader, maybe even more foundational concepts like light exposure, structured water, grounding, and that core philosophy of earning your optimization.
It truly highlights just how exquisitely interconnected our biology is, doesn't it? And how many intelligent levers we actually have available to pull, if we understand them, to achieve profound wellness and peak performance.
Yeah. And this deep dive, it was really designed to give you, the listener, a shortcut, a way to get well-informed quickly and hopefully spark your curiosity to explore further. We really encourage you to consider how these insights might empower your own journey towards health and performance, remembering that it's ultimately about a holistic approach, understanding the why behind what you're doing.
And maybe leave you with a final thought to mull over. In a world where so many basic health principles seem increasingly challenged or forgotten, what unexpected piece of old wisdom, maybe something we dismissed as simple, might actually prove to be the most powerful biohack for navigating the future?
That is a profound question to consider. Thank you so much for joining us on the Deep Dive. We sincerely hope this conversation has sparked new ideas, maybe challenged some assumptions, and given you actionable insights for your own path to optimal health. Remember, this Deep Dive was brought to you by InfinityPeptide.com.